And welcome, welcome, welcome. Good morning, good morning, good morning, dear listeners. Wherever you find yourself, this is the Sunday morning take for this Sunday morning session here in your number one talk radio station. And yes, but these songs or the sounds that you heard just now before my particular salutation for this morning session of my Sunday morning take were the sounds of the Eagles, the band The Eagles, with one of these nights. Obviously bringing us into the start of this morning's particular session after, you know, the previous session that just also appropriated a few minutes from me in that regard. But nonetheless, you're in my company from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. Now, obviously, as we've seen, the world particularly once again go a little bit into the scenario of haywire-ness. Primarily, that is obviously pointing towards the developments of the full-on particular conflict that escalated yesterday, that began yesterday morning, and specifically, you know, blew out into various particular developments coming through. And if you have been staying somewhere under a rock, somewhere hiding yourself, somewhere being, you know, cut off from the overall communication space that even exists in Namibia, what has happened specifically is the United States and Israel have declared full-on war with Iran. And we have to try and understand primarily what's ultimately going on right there. The state of the situation still where, you know, where I left off last night, specifically in terms of being updated about what was going on there, is that there had been various reports supposedly coming out about the supreme leader of Iran, that is the religious leader Khamenei, whether he, you know, has gone into hiding, has either been, you know, has been targeted with one or other particular precision strike, whether he has lost his life regarding that precision strike. There were a lot of reports from Israel, which obviously also, you also have to take into consideration, that the Israeli military is known for running a lot of propaganda during conflict scenarios. And primarily that, you know, we still have to see whether or not things are confirmed. Because it's also a little bit problematic in terms of the known media sources, that we do know, like the BBCs, the Al Jazeeras, and the other particular mainline platforms. It's very difficult for them to establish a lot of things because a lot of their people are not, in many cases, on the ground in Iran. They're positioned outside. So yeah, just primarily giving you some of those particular, starting points when we start in this particular discussion that we've got lined up for this morning session of my Sunday morning take. Now, the particular conversation we had back on Friday, specifically for the home run, that's not with Helmut and myself, where we obviously went into the frightening particular position that the Secretary of State of the United States, Marco Rubio, literally came to applaud and, in some way also pep talk, the European Union and or European nations primarily for their, put in inverted commas, quote unquote, glorious past, which he highlighted in many scenarios was primarily the past of colonialism. Now, we have had this conversation before, not me specifically, Helmut himself, primarily about one of the most problematic legal terms that has very strong roots in colonial endeavors and in colonial activities and in colonialism across the board. And we are once again taking a look specifically at that terminology and the issues it created in a modern day context, regarding, you know, international law and also laws specifically about, whether or not the rights of people who are indigenous to a specific territory have been violated in one or other scenario specifically because of colonialism and this term that was brought forward. Now, here's where things get problematic, dear listeners. And obviously, as you know, you're looking and watching the particular conflict scenario that's currently taking place against Iran. Obviously flouts various particular international laws. Various. And in many scenarios, these are all UN member states primarily participating in this specific scenario, which highlights one or other particular problematic aspect, which was also the same for 3 January, being the respecting of sovereign, the airspace, respecting the particular sovereignty of peoples and governments of a specific territory, as well as also, you know, any other particular, their own other particular rights to existence, because what Donald Trump specifically had been calling for was the complete annihilation of the current Iranian government, which makes things problematic because that is specifically war rhetoric, or what do they call it, warmongering rhetoric in that regard. Now, I pointed towards the concept and the discussion that we will obviously be taking a look for in this morning session, known as terra nullius. Now, if you don't know what it is, dear listeners, terra nullius is I call it a problematic term. It is a term used in international law. It is recognized in international law. However, it is a Latin expression which encapsulates the term or the phrase nobody's land. Now, you can argue that particular part for Antarctica, which is the South Pole. And you can primarily, you know, justify the particular indication, obviously, in terms of how us as humanity approach, you know, land that is not occupied by people. And yes, a place like the South Pole obviously is not occupied by people in terms of identifying anyone indigenous primarily because it is a very extreme environment to imagine. However, a place like the North Pole, Greenland, for example, a place like, who else is there? New Caledonia, which is a French autonomous territory, as it supposedly is, or St. Helena here across from us, a British territory. Obviously, they are supposedly self-autonomous in their own regard, but they are an offshore territory. Hawaii, you could think of Hawaii for the United States as one. Primarily, the reason why I mentioned these 3 countries, France, the UK, and the United States, is primarily they're the only 3 countries in the world that have these offshore territories away from the mainland of what is their nation state, or what is their national territory, that they consider as, you know, part of being some sort of a dominion that they've got. However, that it's primarily territories that have supposedly forms of self-autonomy. I mentioned Hawaii in the United States consideration because Hawaii is, if you've ever looked up the history of Hawaii, Hawaii has a problematic history specifically of being part of the state, the collective of states, federal states of the United States, primarily because there is an ugly situation of similarly, some format of colonialism that has taken place on that island nation itself. You could also argue this primarily of You know, for example, the discussion currently that the US wants Greenland as well for its particular expansionist theory. And obviously the early threats that were made last year to Canada about that extra discussion as well. But that's also citing in that Canada and Australia and, you know, and New Zealand are aspects of dominion to the British government as well, or to, you know, to the British crown as well, for that matter, should I rather say. Now, Terra Nullius, it has a logical component to it, specifically a place that is not occupied by any human, but it's a problematic term that existed primarily to justify who is human and who is not. Terra Nullius exists. It's the Latin expression that means nobody's land. And since the 19th century, it has occasionally been used in international law as a principle to justify claims that territories may be acquired by a state's occupation of it. Like I said there. Now, there are currently three territories, still as we speak today, sometimes called to be or claimed to be Terra Nullius. And these three territories are Bir Tawil, which is a strip of land between Egypt and Sudan. And this is something specifically that the British did. They created this particular scenario as well in terms of the broader Pan-Africanist argument, where the Pan-Africans are arguing that the borders we have are not the borders, are not something that Africans had decided. Which is a definite yes, and primarily that the borders that we have on the African continent was something decided specifically at the Berlin Conference. Yes, once again, completely correct. Those are factual designations. And why was this particular discussion so? Well, primarily because the European powers had to identify who is where, in terms of where they were, so as that they don't shoot each other. It was never about where that African group is and where this African group is and where that other African group stays and this African group is moving. No. It was so that they didn't step on each other's toes. And it was never about considering sort of like in the context of like Botswana, Lesotho, Eswatini for that matter, who were protectorates of the British crown. Just so that you know, they were protectorates. Specifically being that they could know where they also were positioned in this particular scenario of, well, firstly colonialism back then, and ultimately also the particular indications of knowing not to step on whose toes as a colonial power back then. So, which also makes things very tricky, specifically for, let's say, the, for example, what we now call Zambezi, but it was the strip of land known as Caprivi, obviously owned by the gentleman von Caprivi, who obviously, you know, purchased this piece of land from the British, and he decided obviously to connect it back to the fellow rest of the fellow Southwest German territory, which was obviously us. And it makes things very peculiar, specifically in that particular discussion of those Namibians that were making utterances there of breaking away at the end of our last year, of breaking away from the rest of the country, those secessionist rhetorics. So it makes things very problematic for them, primarily because if you have ever to go back into what had been a precedence, is that you can continuously see that what is Zambezi has always been part of Namibia. And the understanding in terms of the breakaway or the joining into Zambia or whatever kind of rhetoric, whoever made those negotiations primarily didn't consider the precedence, the legal precedence of a situation. Now, obviously, regarding that particular point of the borders being established here on the African continent, and also the impacting decisions and discussions that took place, obviously, around you know, the formation of Namibia and the various particular borders of the continent. Terra Nullius has a serious issue. Now, Bir Tawil, which is a strip of land between Egypt and Sudan, is supposedly still Terra Nullius, is still a claimed territory or a claimed piece of land that was designated as Terra Nullius. Now, this area of land along the Egypt and Sudan border is claimed by neither country, supposedly still till today. Now, it also, together with the neighboring Halaib Triangle, is sometimes called a Bir Tawil Triangle, despite its obviously, you know, sort of like four-cornered shape. And it obviously is that these two regions border specifically at a specific point along the Egypt-Sudan border. You also get the four pockets of land near the Danube River due to the Croatia-Serbia border dispute that is still happening. The four pockets, this obviously stems from the Balkan crisis of the 90s, if you guys did not know. The very big country known as Yugoslavia split up into these multiple countries, which are now today Croatia, Serbia, the other one is Bosnia, Herzegovina obviously broke up. Then there is, what's that other country's name? Kosovo is now obviously the newer one. But Kosovo has actually no real governance situation. And it's also an indication of understanding specifically the relationship between all the particular groups there in the former Yugoslavia, primarily about why we've got a situation of four pockets of disputed land between Croatia and Serbia, between the border between them. Now, it's literally four, well, technically I'm counting five here, but it's literally, okay, there's a sixth one, actually. So it's specifically a discussion of where the actual border should flow between Serbia and Croatia. So the border between Croatia and Serbia in the area of the Danube is disputed, and which also highlights an important part of their broader diplomatic relations discussion, being that Serbia claims that the Talvek of the Danube Valley and the center line of the river represents the international border between the two countries. Now, as mentioned, Serbia claims certain parts of it, while Croatia obviously claims the same certain parts of the where the river is literally flowing through, and it's obviously a river valley. And then finally, if you go to the continent of the South Pole, known as the Antarctica, it is the world's most least populated continent, and primarily because this continent is also split up into various portions that are occupied by various particular international scientific missions. The main part, or the only part of the continent of Antarctica, which is declared as Terra Nullius, is Marie Byrd Land. Now, it's known as MBL, and this is an unclaimed region of the Antarctica with a surface area, obviously, of about 1.6 million square kilometers. It is the largest unclaimed territory on the planet. It was also named after the wife of the American naval officer Richard Byrd, who explored the region in the early 20th century. So, Marie Byrd Land, MBL, is unclaimed, by any country on the planet. And it's also declared as being terra nullius, which is claimed by nobody. The other particular positions, obviously, are where the scientific stations are and various scientific expeditions occur, and various particular discussions obviously kick off regarding, you know, the scientific installations. However, terra nullius is technically a doctrine. Now, we'll quickly take a short musical break, dear listeners, and after that, we come back and we head into the history, the doctrine, and the problematic scenarios of what terra nullius actually creates in the modern, if I can say, the modern global community, wherein we've got various countries with various identities, meaning i.e. said particular diversity component, and ultimately what this still carries in the modern day and age. On that note, dear listeners, we take another musical break.
Moving on the
And we come back there from the sound specifically of Duran Duran with the song Rio. And before that, you heard the sounds specifically of INXS with the song Need You Tonight. Now, this brings us further into our discussion for my Sunday morning take, specifically on your number one talk radio station, where we're obviously taking a look at the problematic terminology. And I call it problematic. You know, it obviously hadn't been showered or indicated or designated or highlighted as problematic. But in a basic understanding, in a scope of basic understanding, in a basic concept of understanding, specifically, you know, how one person can literally say, listen, in my eyes, it looks like an unoccupied piece of land. I don't care if you're nomadic. I don't care if you've lived here as a prehistoric civilization. You know, in my understanding, the concept of what a civilization looks like is not what your presentation entails. Now, this doctrine of terra nullius obviously is a pretty old scenario. It's used or applied in international law. And this is primarily to designate that a territory belongs to no state. Now, sovereignty over territory which is terra nullius can be acquired by any state by occupation. And this specifically is a description provided by a gentleman by the name of Oppenheim, whose name is Lasse Francis Lawrence Oppenheim, who was a German jurist. And he's been characterized as being the father of the modern discipline of international law, especially the hard legal positivist school of thought. Now, Oppenheim notes that the only territory which can be the object of occupation is that which does not already belong to another state, whether it is uninhabited or inhabited by persons whose community is not considered to be a state. For individuals may live on a territory without forming themselves into a state proper exercising sovereignty over such territory. Hence the reason why I call it problematic. And this is obviously understanding specifically in terms of how the modern scope of international law obviously also has a little bit of a wonky presentation to it, because in many scenarios, in many discussions, yes, you would have certain civilizations positioning themselves in order to formulate themselves. But they obviously had to formulate themselves because of various particular disputes that occurred. Said particular disputes obviously was based upon disputes over land. I mean, you can look at the whole of European history, in many cases, the whole of Asian history. In some scenarios, probably in ancient South American civilizations, which were the Mayans, the Incas, the Aztecs, you would probably find some disputes in African context. And I'm talking about medieval Africa, ancient African discussions, and even as recently as, for example, the period under which Shaka Zulu and various other particular African figures of prominence of, you know, from territories that were not yet colonized in Africa, the concept of terra nullius would also be problematic. I say this primarily because you've got to look at the lens from whose perspective is the term terra nullius applied by. Even in preparation for this conversation, the other particular subject matter that I was pondering was the presentation and the history of the territory which we know as Taiwan, and its particular, you know, its particular connection to mainland China. Now, in the discussion, obviously, of when you look, for example, at a territory like Taiwan, Taiwan has had a rich history of, well, to use the word relations is a little bit over the top, primarily because much of the Chinese settlements came obviously during the periods when they had, the Chinese settlements on Taiwan happened because of various particular, let's call it, resettling expeditions that the Chinese did. And I'm talking about in medieval periods. I'm talking about in the particular monarchy period, when China obviously had the various emperors and the dynasties of those emperors. There was a lot of Chinese village settlements that were always positioned on the island of Taiwan. Now, when I say this, it's also not clearly stated specifically that these various medieval societies, like these fishing Chinese fishing villages and various particular installations, whether or not they actually pointed towards medieval Chinese dynasties were trying to colonize the island of Taiwan. However, in Taiwan's own particular scenario, they also had indigenous peoples. And I think there's still like last remnants of those people still on the island of Taiwan. They had like their own specific last, you know, but their own indigenous, let's call it representation there as well. Each on a specific part of the island of Taiwan. And now Taiwan is pretty, it's a pretty sizable piece of real estate. I mean, it's, I think, half of Madagascar. And it's sizable. Half of Madagascar. Madagascar is as big or bigger than Namibia. So it's pretty sizable in its own right. Now, that particular conversation right there, not to say never, but there obviously would have been concerted efforts in ancient Chinese history, or in medieval Chinese history, or even in relative Chinese history, I mean up until 1900 probably, where there would have been concerted efforts of trying to absorb the territory of Taiwan as being a, you know, just like you would have a Reunion, which is one of the particular dominions of France, a New Caledonia, what's the other place's name? There's literally a small island cluster close to Canada, which the French still have as a territory. And there's obviously that small island here close to Tanzania, Mayotte, also French territory. And you could see with these particular examples that I'm highlighting to you that, you can argue, specifically in the One China policy of modern day China, that, oh, this is the presentation being given specifically that it is an extension of mainland China. Now, not to put that particular part separately, in terms of that conversation. However, when you've got to look at the placing claim over a piece of territory, you've got to look at what actually happened on that territory first, and who are the particular concerned parties that form part of this particular territorial dispute. For example, there's currently the Chagos Island cluster, where the U.S. naval base, Diego Garcia, is based here in the Indian Ocean, on the other side of Mauritius. This base, Diego Garcia, is, as mentioned, it operates as a refueling station primarily for the United States Navy. It's owned by the British government, owned, put that in inverted commas, primarily because what the British government did is they, I think this is in early 1900s or at the end of the 1800s, the British government forcefully moved the Chagosians, which are the indigenous people of the island cluster of the Chagos Island cluster, where this naval base by the Americans is positioned. They forcefully removed those people and positioned them on Mauritius in order to make the island literally like sort of like empty. You know, you empty out the island of any peoples that were living there by putting them on boats and shifting them somewhere else. Now, as you can obviously see, dear listeners, the problematic scenario that exists immediately from that explanation that I just presented to you is literally the problematic scenario of what the Chagos Island debacle represents. Now, currently in the U.S. Senate or in the U.S. Congress, one of the two, I always get confused in terms of who is the upper house and who is the lower house. There's currently an American politician. He is the cousin of the current Secretary of Health of the United States, that other Kennedy guy. This one's name is also Kennedy. The one is John, the other one is Robert. I always get confused between the two. But they are cousins, literally, these two men. And the one that's not the Secretary of Health is now literally lobbying that the British do not hand over and pay reparations for the forceful disposition, land disposition, or the forceful land removal of the Chagossians. Primarily because of this naval base. Now, if you're trying to look for an actual base with buildings and the likes, it's problematic. Because the photos you'll find on the internet won't easily show you, like, built structures and stuff. However, it supposedly features as a refueling station or a resupply station. The Chagossians are facing an uphill struggle because this is one of the world's two foremost naval powers, the world's two foremost deciding nations when it comes to international law, meaning they can easily say, I don't agree with your term, and then just go on with life, and then you're just stuck there with, you know, with your feelings stuck in your palm of your hand, and then you're just wondering, okay, where to next? What avenue of recourse, what avenue of restitution do I have left? And these are two countries, the United Kingdom and the US, they could care less specifically in that regard about providing restitution in any form or manner. I say this primarily because, precedence has been the worst for these two countries. Precedence is the worst thing you can look for with these two countries. When they create a precedent, they can literally argue against it later on. So, you see these particular scenarios kicking off, obviously, and creating various particular problematic aspects. Now, the occupation or occupation of terra nullius is one of several ways in which a state can actually acquire territory under international law. The other means of acquiring territory is obviously through conquest, cession by agreement, accretion through the operations of nature, and prescription through the continuous exercise of sovereignty. Now, currently today, obviously, things are problematic because to claim terra nullius today would only be for either small territories, either large and undefended or heavily underinvested territories. Supposedly, like Donald Trump claims that Greenland is underinvested by the Danes, but the Greenlanders probably have access to probably one of the best healthcare services in the world, which is 100% state subsidized. So it makes things problematic in terms of the Americans claiming that the Greenlanders have poor health care versus the Danes that literally give you 100% subsidized state health care, which is also problematic because the Danes are literally known as the world's happiest country by 2025 standards or measurements, which makes things further problematic regarding the claims that the Americans obviously had made, in that you try to understand, okay, so if you firstly see the results of the first two claims that I've just highlighted to you, why would it be a problem to try and identify problematic areas that the Greenlanders supposedly suffer deficiencies from? Now, the history of the term terra nullius and its particular application, obviously, was not used in international law before the late 19th century. Some writers and authors have traced the concept to the Roman law term known as res nullius. Now, res nullius is a term under Roman law meaning things belonging to no one. So this obviously would have been also another problematic area. Because when you obviously have to look at possessions, property, property law, and all those other particular indications, is that identity of an owner, identity of a master would be crucial scenarios in, let's call it the ancient world for that matter, because they're citing Roman law here, and Roman law technically forms part of the ancient world. So what was that? Well, it's a particular scenario where disputes had to be solved by one way or another, which did not include blades, knives, hammers, or all-out war, for that matter. Now, a person can assume ownership, and this is under the Roman legal term of res nullius. A person can assume ownership of res nullius simply by taking possession of the item, which is also known as occupatio. Occupatio, literally occupation. Now, in Roman law, things that were res nullius, such as wild animals, lost slaves, abandoned buildings, could be taken as property by anyone by seizure. By anyone by seizure. Now remember, by anyone does not include slaves under Roman law, because the particular discussion back then was that slaves were a commodity. They were a product. They were spoils of war. They were obviously means in terms of which the nations of the Mediterranean at the time ensured that their economies were continuously functioning, is that they needed cheap labor. Other experts have stated that the derivation, meaning to derive from res nullius or from any other particular legal term, but the derivation of terra nullius from res nullius is in many cases by analogy only, meaning people only analyzed was there something similar by which the ancient Romans operated by and thus extrapolated a term or a particular phrase or a particular legal term so as to justify the contemporary actions of occupation that were obviously taking place. 16th century writings also highlighted or put a spotlight on the res nullius terminology and its particular impact, and that they cited, which were obviously the context under which it was used in European colonization of the New World. The New World obviously cites North America, South America. Well, primarily it has to do with the Western Hemisphere. Let me just say that. North America, South America, the Caribbean, and Central America. And the particular doctrine of discovery that was obviously also applied. Now, the doctrine of discovery, or the doctrine of the discovery doctrine, or the doctrine of discovery, is a disputed interpretation of international law during the age of discovery. Once again, citing to you, dear listeners, it is a problematic aspect to still uphold, primarily in the modern day post-1945 world, which is the same particular problematic perspective that Marco Rubio specifically has an issue with. Meaning, everyone has an identity, all the, so 190 plus nation states around the world are not allowed to have their own particular destinies, should not have their own particular industrial policies and directions, shouldn't have their own goals, shouldn't have their own ambitions, and ultimately should not try and become equals. Now, in 1535, Domingo de Soto, who was a Spanish Dominican priest and a scholastic theologian and a naturalist born in Spain, from in Segovia in Spain, argued that Spain had no right to the Americas because the lands had not been res nullius at the time of discovery. Francisco de Vitoria, in 1539, 4 years later, also used the term, or also used the res nullius analogy to argue that the indigenous populations of the Americas, and he identified them as supposedly being barbarian, had both sovereignty and private ownership over their lands, and that the Spanish had gained no legal right to possession through mere discovery of these lands. Nevertheless, obviously, Vitoria, stated that the Spanish possibly had a limited right to rule indigenous Americans because the latter obviously were unsuited, and this is a term, a phrase I am quoting, were unsuited to setting up or administering a commonwealth, both legitimate and ordered in human and civil terms. Once again, the aspect of civility and the aspect of what is human was obviously something that was highly disputed at the time. Now, we quickly take a short musical break, dear listeners. This is as we have reached the midway point of our discussion for today. We come back right after that, heading into the second half of this morning session of My Sunday Morning Take. Stay tuned. This is your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM, and you're in my company here on My Sunday Morning Take from 5 a.m. to 6 to 7 a.m., almost at 6 a.m. And on that note, we'll be back right after the short musical break, guys.
Experience. I'm here to see the candy man. She said it would feel that good, and it does.
Thank you.
Coming back there from the sounds of Take That with We Got All Day, primarily. Just apologies in terms of the mix-up of the songs. The one was not meant to play, to play, but nonetheless, we find ourselves obviously in the second half of this morning's session of my Sunday Morning Take. Now, as obviously the earliest Spanish, sort of, if we can call them scholars and thinkers, were trying to position that the term terra nullius was problematic in its own right. They also had their particular biases that obviously fed into their particular analogies that they obviously tried to provide, or analyses for that matter. Another particular thinker at the time, Alberico Gentili, who was an Italian jurist, who was also a tutor to monarchy, and also a standing advocate for, while being a representative of the Spanish embassy in London at the time, and this is obviously in the 1500s. He wrote in his particular, in one of his particular sort of like scholarly works, De Jure Belli Libri Tres, which drew a distinction between the legitimate occupation of land that was res nullius and the illegitimate claims of sovereignty through discovery and occupation of land that was not res nullius, as in the case of the Spanish claim to the Americas. Hugo Grotius, who was also known as Hugo de Groot, wrote in 1625 and also stated that discovery does not give a right to sovereignty over inhabited land. And for discovery, he said, for discovery applies to those things which belong to no one. End of quote. Now, obviously, by the 18th century, however, some writers argued that territorial rights over land could stem from the settlement and cultivation of said land. For example, the likes of William Blackstone in 1765, who wrote, plantations or colonies in distant countries, or either such where the lands are claimed by right of occupancy alone, or occupancy only, by finding them desert and uncultivated, and peopling them from the mother country, or where, when already cultivated, they have been either gained by conquest or ceded to us by treaties, and both these rights are founded upon the law of nature, or at least upon that of nations, end of quote. There's a lot of problems in that particular statement, because it obviously cites a problematic thinking at the time, which obviously is not as well informed as we have obviously today. Several years after Blackstone's interpretation of res nullius, another gentleman by the name of Emer de Vattel, in his La Droit des Gentes of 1758 drew a distinction between land that was effectively occupied and cultivated and the unsettled and uncultivated land of nomads, which was open to colonization. So as we obviously see, the Berlin West Africa Conference of 1884 to 1885 obviously endorsed the principle that sovereignty over an unclaimed territory required effective occupation, and that where native populations had established effective occupation, their sovereignty could not be unilaterally overturned by a colonizing state. Now, the term terra nullius was then used in 1885 in relation to the dispute between Spain and the U.S. over Contoy Island. Now, Contoy Island is a small island in the Mexican state of Quintana Roo, which is about 30 kilometers north of another particular Mexican territory. Now, Hermann Eduard von Heust, who also another particular thinker at the time, indicated that Kontoi was not, in an international sense, a desert, and that it is, and that it was also, it, that it is an abandoned island, and hence constitutes terra nullius. In 1888, the Institut de Droit International introduced the concept of territorium nullius, meaning nobody's territory, as a public law equivalent to the private law concept of res nullius. And by 1909, the Italian international jurist Camille Piccioni described the island of Spitsbergen in the Arctic Circle as terra nullius, even though the island was inhabited by the nationals of several European countries and the inhabitants did not live under any formal sovereignty. Which is an interesting thing to do specifically because currently right now, as we're sitting here in 2026, there are like 7 or 8 countries that claim Antarctica or pieces of Antarctica as extensions of their national territories. South Africa is one. Australia is another. The United Kingdom is one. The United States is one. Russia is one. I think France is one. Argentina is one. Yeah. The thing that is weird is that no other African country obviously has, you know, paid attention to also doing the same specifically over Antarctica. But yeah, this is obviously for countries that have massive budgets for their navies, massive budgets for research and development, and massive budgets obviously to be able to go and spend money on literally analyzing the natural environment out there. Whereas if you take a look here in an African context, the discussion obviously about research and development and scientific developments are conversations that are very limited as they're currently happening as we speak, and very limited in the particular case of capabilities in terms of researchers and scientists that we would like to develop. They either get to work directly in government or they work for other international platforms, or they become lecturers in many scenarios, instead of actually being that we have actual researchers out in the field trying to discover things for the betterment, for the improvement of Namibian society. Not to say that we don't have, guys. Let me also speak under that particular correction. However, in 2026, it is just problematic that no African country has claimed a piece of Antarctica specifically for research and development. However, this obviously should not, you know, sort of like deter us from our own particular goals, as Africans. But we obviously see that the discussion of terra nullius being flouted and being thrown about, not willy-nilly, but rather more like a thinking being applied by many, many particular thinkers about how they consider or how they view or what their perspective on this particular legal term is. Now, decades after the 1909 classification by Piccioni, the term terra nullius gradually replaced territorium nullius. Now, Fitz Morris, another particular thinker at the time, argued that the two concepts were initially distinct. Territorium nullius applying to territory in which the inhabitants may have property rights but had not developed political sovereignty, whereas terra nullius referred to an absence of property. Now, this is where things get interesting. I say this is where things get interesting because in Africa you've got something like nomadic societies or nomadic peoples. The Tuareg are one. The Sun in Namibia and in Botswana and in, because there's not much sun left in South Africa. So technically it's Namibia and Botswana. They are also nomadic. And what that technically means is They are not farmers. They are not pastoralists. They do not have animals. Even, for example, like the examples that I know exist in Namibia, for example, where the Namibian government has bought and handed over resettlement farms in the Omeke region to various Sun communities. And I'm using the Sun community just as a term, as an umbrella term, and obviously not getting into the individual names of each of the particular groups, because they consider more to be identified by their groups and not by this overarching name or term, is that trying to apply the thinking of agriculture to peoples or communities who have never practiced agriculture for the thousands of years of existence that you would find in their DNA, in their spirit, is problematic in its own right. Why do I say it's problematic in its own right? It's primarily because you see it's an action that is against a way of life that had been known for eons, for millennia, for thousands of years. So you ask yourself the particular question, if we sit with a situation specifically where there are nomadic peoples, and the Laplanders also in Europe, for example, are the same too, which also comes into conflict with the various particular developmental policies that, for example, the Finnish government and the Norwegian government have to trying to, it's not a discussion of domestication, but it's more a discussion of that they're trying to anchor the Laplanders into either one or the other society. Now, the Laplanders, they are pastoralists because they farm with a wild animal. What's the animal's name? The moose. They farm with, not moose, it's not a moose. What is it? It's a pretty big herbivore. What's that? It's a reindeer. Yeah, they farm with reindeer. And they are similar to like the Tuareg. The Tuareg only farm with, they've got their goats, but they only farm with goats and what's the thing's name? And camels. And because they are nomadic, meaning they move from territory, from spot to spot to spot, it creates a little bit of a problematic scenario specifically, in that regard. Now, you will not hear much primarily about what those two European governments are doing in terms of how they try to anchor the Laplanders. But the Laplanders, if you go and look at them, if you go and try and understand, you know, who these people are, you would realize that they are very closely related to the Inuit peoples that you would find in Greenland, the Inuit peoples that you would find in Alaska. And then you would realize that, these are people that literally live off the land. Now, terra nullius, res nullius, territorium nullius, all these particular legal terms make things problematic because there are literally people on this planet who don't want national identity. Now, you've got to ask yourself the particular question, obviously as a listener, what is national identity? And if you have people on this planet that literally don't care for national identity, they don't care. And when I say national identity, I'm not talking about your ID document, a birth certificate. I'm not talking about those various particular, information collection mechanisms that the state has in order to understand how many people live within a specific zone. No, national identity is not caring whether you are Namibian, Finnish, Angolan, all those labels, not caring about that term or that terminology, primarily because There's a way of life that has its own identity versus a national identity, which is a political construct. So we obviously see that in this particular conversation, how things literally become weird. Now, all the arguments that I've cited to you just now, from the, well, not to say that they are foremost, but mostly that they are the most prominent voices associated to this conversation matter, or this piece of conversation matter, all of them speak from a perspective of being or having a national identity. Meaning, are you Spanish? Are you Portuguese? And what does it mean to be Spanish? And what does it mean to be Portuguese? Or what does it mean to be French? Or what does it mean to be German or British at the time? It doesn't take into consideration the other perspective that would exist at the time. The other perspective that would be the people that ultimately, for example, for the first time saw Columbus, Christopher Columbus's ship rock up there in the Caribbean, and they're like, what is this massive, you know, soapbox of a ship? What kind of a thing is this? And you get to answer this, but ask this particular question, because in the statement that Marco Rubio gave in the, back in last month, because obviously today is the 1st of March, back in last month at the Munich Security Conference, Marco Rubio was hailing and praising the 500 years of, put in inverted commas, civilization that Europe had achieved. Once again, not taking into consideration the other perspective that exists. Why do I say this? Let me put this way, dear listeners. In history, you do not just have one narrative, unfortunately. Scientific thinking tries to achieve what were the perspectives on both sides, and maintaining a neutral position, as is not having a bias one way or a bias the other way, but rather maintaining that middle ground in terms of saying, okay, so when Christopher Columbus showed up on his soapbox in his floating tub, the indigenous communities of the various Caribbean islands were these kinds of peoples, and the earliest collected perspectives from them in relations obviously to Spanish records at the time, because Christopher Columbus sailed under a Spanish flag, just so that you guys know. He did not sail under an Italian flag because he was an Italian. He sailed, and Italy did not exist back then. It was just these independent Italian states, these principalities, as they were sometimes would be known. Christopher Columbus sailed under an Italian flag. So, you then try to get to understand as a historian, or as a connoisseur of history in one or other manner, what were the two perspectives of the time? Meaning about the same particular event, when Christopher Columbus approached the first Caribbean island, and when the first native Caribbean indigenous communities witnessed Columbus approaching them. What were the perspectives? Now, things become problematic primarily because the discussion of Panama that I gave you guys last week, about the discovery, the rumored existence of the seven cities of Cibola, or the seven cities of gold, was primarily that kind of problematic actions and problematic behavior, for example, that was conducted back then. And it's known, if you ever go and look it up in a further expansion of this discussion of history, early colonialism and later colonialism. Now, what is early colonialism? Early colonialism was what we have been discussing so far here in on this morning session of my Sunday Morning Take, primarily because the worst of the worst of scenarios played out. Late colonialism, as being highlighted by historians, were, for example, places like Namibia, or places like Botswana. But Botswana was a protectorate still. But Namibia is one of those particular indications of late colonialism. Why do I say late colonialism? Well, first and foremost, Namibia obviously has 35 years or 36 years of independence, whereas a country like Venezuela has almost 200 years of independence. A country like Brazil, almost 200 years of independence. And many of those countries, I think, are older than the United States, or comparatively in a similar age range, just like the United States. Because Donald Trump mentioned that the U.S. independence is 250 years old last year. Speaking under correction. Which is obviously the thing that they wanted to, the particular event that he also wants to celebrate. So it helps to outline primarily how you've got to view this particular subject matter. Now, weighing up the thinking, the perspectives that obviously had taken place, makes things weird. Now, Europeans obviously could argue many things in history, primarily for the early perspectives that they had on the rest of the world, and that the rest of the world did not care for where Europe was. However, but it did bring the rest of the world into direct conflict with Europe. It's a good thing that they mentioned the Berlin Conference here, because it primarily was a problematic scenario. And obviously, what is a new age 2026 problematic scenario is the Donroe Doctrine, which is a copycat, copy and paste aspect of the Monroe Doctrine of the 1800s. Reason being primarily, and you can clearly see this, it literally has the same particular influence or scale or rate of influence, just like it tries to achieve it to an extent, just like the Samoa Agreement. But in many cases, when we've got to look at development going ahead from 2026 in this direction, you know, as time obviously moves, time moves far forward, things are just going to get even more problematic. The statement that you've got to look at of 3 weeks ago, no, not 3 weeks, 2 weeks ago, by Marco Rubio, literally means that the Global South is once again under threat. It is primarily that reason why we had that conversation on Friday of the home run, because you've got to look at things through the particular perspectives. And yes, in many scenarios, people would say, ah, don't listen to a politician. Ah, what do they know? Ah, you know, what do they think? But 2025 and 2026 have literally been living up to certain particular precedents, and those said precedents are problematic. In many scenarios, they actually pose existential threats to countries like Namibia, who are developing countries, countries with mineral deposits, countries who are trying to chart their own course in terms of establishing their own national identity. Yes, a country like Namibia would walk up into the global stage and say, listen, we are an enemy of no one. We appreciate all manner of bilateral relations as long as it is grounded in mutual respect for both sides. So that means if you are at war with someone else that we also have bilateral relations with, please, it's got nothing to do with me. That's a story between the two of you guys. That is literally Namibia's particular stance. But the thinking that still exists in the global north is problematic because it's the thinking of it's either my way or we interpret other actions. And those interpretations can be left up to your particular thinking. Before we continue, dear listeners, we quickly take another short musical break and we come back after this.
Déjate llevar por el ritmo de la música. Libera tu espíritu. Sigue tus instintos.
Fiesta. Somos una con la música y con el espacio.
Coming back there from the sound specifically of Groove Armada with Romance. And before that was a little bit of the, what was that guy's name? The particular songs of Ten Snake with Fiesta Magica. Or Fiesta Magica, should I rather say. Not Magica, Magica, Magica. Now, as we are heading to, you know, into the last 16 minutes of this morning session here together. Now, we left off just before the musical break about the problematic statement that came out from the Munich Security Conference 2026. The problematic thinking that is aligned with that statement in its own right. and the problematic approach towards international relations regarding how you need to view the particular statement in its own right and the particular developments that obviously have taken shape and kicked off across the world. So, Terra Nullius was adopted by the International Court of Justice in its 1975 Western Sahara Advisory Opinion. Now, it is also known that International Court of Justice is also known as the World Court, which is the principal judicial organ of the UN, which settles legal disputes that are submitted to it by states and provides advisory opinions on legal questions. Now, the majority wrote specifically in this particular discussion of the particular term being applied in that regard was that the occupation being legally on original, being legally an original means of peaceably acquiring sovereignty over another territory otherwise than by cession or succession, it was a cardinal condition of a valid occupation that the territory should be terra nullius, meaning a territory belonging to no one. And at the time of the act, alleged to constitute the occupation. Now, why, you would be asking, have I, specifically me, Dwight, viewed the problematic stance that the AU has taken on Western Sahara? Because the problematic view that the AU took was that the political machinations of Western Sahara had to literally view, since 1975, the discussion, the dispute that took place between, that has been taking place between the Kingdom of Morocco and Mauritania. Now, Western Sahara, for that matter, in history, had been identified as a Moroccan territory. I say in history had been identified as a Moroccan territory. Not by the views of the AU, not by the views of whoever would be a sympathizer specifically with the liberation effort, the liberation efforts of the Western Saharan people. You have to view this from what has been there in history, not what I feel since today, 2026, 1 March, should be the picture. Now, when you obviously view this particular context, when you obviously particularly view this particular development, it also helps you to look at something from multiple perspectives. Now the court, the ICJ, the court found that at the time of Spanish colonization in 1884, the inhabitants of Western Southern Sahara were nomadic but socially and politically organized in tribes and under chiefs competent to represent them. According to state practice of the time, the territory therefore was not terra nullius. Now, even what I just said, and even though what the court had highlighted and found back at the time, there were a lot of people claiming ownership of the territory. Now, yes, us as Africans, we obviously, you know, we've got a great aversion towards colonialism. We've got a great aversion towards the maltreatment of others. We do. But we also need to highlight that there are problematic scenarios in the broader scope of things. What are these problematic scenarios? Well, in the case of Western Sahara, Mauritania also claims Western Sahara. It's not just Morocco. Even though Morocco has been vilified as the supposedly bad guy in this discussion, it is not just Morocco that lays claim to Western Sahara. Mauritania does the same too. So, We obviously face, in an African context, also something problematic because the Spanish were there. But the Spanish also occupied the whole of Morocco and not just Western Sahara Morocco. They did. Guys, just to let you know, the Spanish did. So, currently, as I've highlighted to you, that there are technically three particular known examples of Terra Nullius perspectives or Terra Nullius scenarios that are currently in play. And it supposedly also includes Palestine, for that matter. Because the Israelis have used the term Terra Nullius as well in terms of their justification for the dispossession of Palestinians from land. And this obviously has been also a very controversial perspective. But the known territories that are claimed as the known ones, Palestine is highly nuanced. The known ones is literally the Bir Tawal between Egypt and Sudan, the Marie Bird land, section of land on the South Pole. And then the place known as Gornja Siga and other pockets of territory along the Croatia-Serbia border. Those are the known specific scenarios of Terra Nullius disputed territories. Now, historically, just before, you know, the last few minutes runs out here on this morning session of my Sunday Morning Take, historically, other territories that have been claimed supposedly to be Terra Nullius were, if we start in Africa, Burkina Faso and Niger. They have been claimed Terra Nullius, and this is obviously as, even though the international and domestic courts had ruled on whether the territory is or was Terra Nullius or not, but in Africa, Burkina Faso and Niger were claimed Terra Nullius. Okay, it's not Burkina Faso and, you know, the whole countries. So, let me correct that. It's not the two countries that were claimed. They had a border dispute as well. And the particular section of the border was also just like the Croatia-Serbia example. Western Sahara obviously is highlighted. Then you've got in Asia, it was the Pinnacle Islands. The Pinnacle Islands is between Japan and China. The Saudi Arabia and Iraqi neutral zone. You had the Saudi and the Kuwaiti neutral zone after that. You then had the Scarborough Shoal, which is found in the South China Sea, and this is between China, Taiwan, and Philippines, who claim the shoal itself. It's obviously islands. It's obviously a particular archipelago, collection of pieces of land. You also have in Europe, Ireland also had a particular problematic scenario, specifically with its own colonial history with England. This is as the term Terra Nullius had been applied by some modern academics in discussing the English colonization of Ireland, although the term is not used in international law sense and is often used as an analogy. Now, this is obviously as the Irish have a huge, they've got an ugly history with the British in that regard, and obviously that the Irish and British relations, it is, if I should rather say, slightly, you know, sensitive in its own right, because it was almost once again brought to the fore up until what was it, 2022 with Brexit. And just to give you an overview of that particular discussion, there is this treaty between the Republic of Ireland, Northern Ireland, and the United Kingdom that exists, known as the Good Friday Agreement. Now, the Good Friday Agreement, dear listeners, yes, literally, as you could obviously see, because the Republic of Ireland is predominantly Catholic, and in the Republic and in Northern Ireland, the reason, the biggest problem for in modern day Irish history had been the firstly the religious and political tensions between Protestant Irish in Northern Ireland and the Catholic Irish in Northern Ireland, not in the Republic of Ireland, not in the rest of Ireland, being that they had a particular difference in terms of what direction should this territory of Northern Ireland head towards. And it obviously was a position specifically wherein, you know, you actually saw the bad of British colonialism in Northern Ireland. Now, Northern Ireland is governed as one of the territories of the United Kingdom. So you've got Scotland, Wales, England, and Northern Ireland. And that particular consideration has always been that in order for the political tensions to come to an end, all parties had to agree towards some sort of a peaceful agreement regarding where Northern Ireland goes from here. Now,
what's not to love about USAVE's special end of February combo? For just 589 Namibian dollars, you can get 10 kilogram bags of each of the following essential foods: Champion Super Maize Meal, Nice Rice Parboiled Rice, Bokoma Fit Cooked Flour, and Marathon Brown or White Sugar. That's just 589 Namibian dollars for 4 10 kilogram bags of essential products. Yes, we all save at USAVE.
So, when you had to look at the Irish discussion, the former UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson was this close to literally contravening the Good Friday Agreement, primarily because of the Brexit discussion, meaning the UK exiting from the European Union, in terms of, economy, and as well as also in terms of other particular aspects, but it was the main political motivations were based upon economic perspectives or economic promises supposedly that were made, which apparently have not materialized. I say apparently because, you know, I'm not going to fact check what the British are arguing about currently as we speak. Now, why would it have brought the, would it have come into disrepute with the Good Friday Agreement? This was based upon basic understanding of where taxation, meaning cross-border taxation, would have taken place. Importation and exportation of goods from, into and from Northern Ireland. The British could not decide or give a clear answer to Ireland, who, the Republic of Ireland, who is, what's the thing's name? They are an EU member state, because EU rules would have been, where does cross-border taxation take place? Does it take place between Ireland and Northern Ireland? Or does it take place between, in the Sea of Ireland, between Northern Ireland and Scotland? Now, when you sit with that particular indication, sit you with that particular sort of like, and it doesn't sound difficult, but in the broader scheme of things, it was complex because the EU would then say, if the UK made a decision, okay, let's put it on the island of Ireland between Northern Ireland and Ireland, then the people of Northern Ireland would be paying a hefty amount of taxes for goods moving from Ireland into Northern Ireland and vice versa. Because there was an agreement also of no taxation. For example, you know, they didn't pay taxes for goods moving between Dublin and Belfast and Belfast and Dublin in that regard. Dublin is in North, is in Ireland, and Belfast is in Northern Ireland, just as you guys know. And they literally opposite each other, these two cities. Belfast, the capital of Northern Ireland, and Dublin, the capital of Ireland. So, it would have brought, Brexit would have brought, would have been in direct conflict with the Good Friday Agreement. And, obviously, as you can see, how problematic that particular positioning is, specifically because, well, I'll just end up with this last particular sort of like observation. Because we have, or we see, we view that a lot of people do not read history, or they forget what has happened in history. And you would start realizing that there's a lot of similarities happening or starting to happen and occur that have happened before. And on that particular note, dear listeners, as I have also appropriated a sufficient amount of time, post the ending time of this morning session of my Sunday morning take, we'll see each other again, same time, same place next week. Alternatively, you can still catch me during the course of this coming week, which is the first week of March, obviously, where Helmut and I obviously will be dissecting some of the very interesting discussions that we always do in terms of helping to explain the developments that are occurring. On that note, dear listeners, stay tuned for the next program to come on after the break. You're now listening to My Sunday Morning Take, the show where we dive into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else in between to help you make sense of how it works around you from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. every Sunday. Want to take a trip through history's major events or explore interesting geographical features and even some interesting scientific developments? Well, join us on My Sunday Morning Take every Sunday morning from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. where we look into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else to help you understand what is happening in the world.
Ripura nengelo wapungwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweko tete okoye ekukulile oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshuana onongeshe fa ya pumbo kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa nune uto otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe fa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendi finawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa ninge fata fanona monika ko Eagle FM onora esatimwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile konderewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu matatu o mafelane Eagle FM the eye.